Welcome to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Zellin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. This episode features an interview with Charles Lister, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Doha Center and a senior consultant with the Sheikh Group. He is the author of the new book, The Syrian Jihad, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, and the Evolution of an Insurgency.
In this episode, we talked about his book, in particular background on Islamism and jihadism in Syria prior to the 2011 uprising, the entrance and evolution of the groups Jabhat al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, and Jaish al-Islam into what became the Syrian War, why foreign fighters came into the Syrian conflict, why the Islamic State of Iraq, which is what IS was calling itself at the time, decided to enter the conflict in April 2013, and what it was up to prior to the fitna between it and the other organizations in January 2014, and what the growth of ISIS and later IS meant for the other extreme factions, Jabhat al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, and Jaish al-Islam.
After the interview, we'll have a new hashtag social media segment covering postings from November 11th through the 20th. And for all the patrons of the show, I've set up an email newsletter that'll be going out, which will have the background content and all of the extra stuff we're putting out for the patrons, which will make it a little bit easier to follow and get updated about that content. And if you haven't supported the show on Patreon, you can check out the link in the show notes where you can make a small donation to help keep the show going.
The center of the jihadi world is based in Syria now. Charles Lister has mapped out the evolution and history of what has occurred in the past few years in his new book, The Syrian Jihad, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, and the Evolution of an Insurgency. Thanks for coming on to the show today, Charles.
Thanks, Aaron. Great to be on again.
So before we get into the current war, I think it's important to take a step back and contextualize the Syrian jihadi trend prior to 2011. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the Muslim Brotherhood, splinter faction, the fighting vanguard, up through the Afghan Jihad and the networks in the 90s. And then finally, the facilitation and logistics networks for the Iraq Jihad, which were based in Syria.
Of course, yeah. The Assad family, both Bashar al-Assad and his father Hafez, have had a kind of complicated and at most times conflicted relationship with Islamists in general in Syria. And you can trace back what's going on today in the revolution, in some respects, back to the 1980s, when the Assad family, and particularly Hafez as the then president, really started to come into direct conflict with what was then the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood and a splinter faction of that organization known as Al-Talia al-Muqatila, or the Fighting Vanguard. Of course, there's, you know, several famous incidents during the early 1980s, most especially the so-called Hama massacre, which followed on from a fairly significant attack in Aleppo that the Fighting Vanguard conducted against the Syrian army. Throughout a number of years in the early 1980s, the Brotherhood was essentially the main opposition organization against Hafez al-Assad's rule in Syria, against the Ba'ath Party rule. But this splinter faction, the Fighting Vanguard, really emerged as the main sort of militant opposition to Hafez himself. But after the Hama massacre, any inkling of resistance in Syria was pretty much destroyed. And in fact, most of the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood was in fact forced into exile, as well as the sort of militant splinter wing essentially ceased to exist. At that point, many of the senior Syrians within the Fighting Vanguard, those who survived, many of them ended up going abroad. Some of them went to Saudi Arabia, some of them went into Lebanon, and some went to places like Afghanistan in the mid-1980s and late 1980s. Many, in fact, also went to Europe. So it was kind of at that early point in the 1980s that this kind of Syrian Islamist diaspora began to emerge. And as I said at the beginning of this comment, it's some of that diaspora, some of this sort of older generation, the people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s who have in fact come back to Syria in the last 3-4 years to take part in the revolution. Many of these individuals have played a fairly prominent role in establishing certain Islamist factions, as well as lending, you know, serious sort of senior credibility to some other groups. So, I mean, the 1980s would be one significant period I would highlight that sort of at the sort of the beginning stages in terms of how it relates to the revolution today. I guess the second most significant period of time would be the early and mid 2000s, following the US invasion of Iraq in 2003. At least in terms of how it relates to the revolution as things are today. I guess what was interesting, one extremely important figure in that respect was a guy named Mahmoud al-Alagasi, who's better known as Abu al-Qaqa. He was a Syrian who, and I highlight a bit about him in my book. I mean, there's an interesting story. I know a senior, former senior Syrian police official quite well, and he told me this story about how when he was in charge of the Aleppo Police Department in the late 1990s, this young guy was brought in by Syrian military intelligence into his office one morning. He described him as being dressed in shalwar kameez. He said he basically looked like an Afghan. But Syrian military intelligence officers basically said, you know, this guy's a Syrian. We're putting him in Aleppo. He's come from abroad. We're housing him in this city, and we want you to give him, you know, all of his various ID documents, a driver's license, et cetera, et cetera. But the strange thing was that these military intelligence officers refused to provide Aleppo police any name for this guy. So essentially, he was given ID documents with no name on it. So it was a totally bizarre situation, which in some respects, as this Aleppo police commander told me at the time, wasn't entirely unusual. So he didn't necessarily think a huge amount about it. But of course, it was only several years later, once the US invasion of Iraq had begun, that this guy, Abu al-Qaqa, had emerged as a real sort of central pro-jihadist figure in the city of Aleppo and a real mobilizing force for the new foreign fighter networks that ended up traveling from Syria into Iraq. And Abu al-Qaqa himself, there were a number of rumors surrounding him for some years, including pre the Iraq invasion in 2003, that he had this relationship with the Syrian regime and with the Assad family. But nothing was ever really particularly confirmed at the time. But I think his relationship with the state became gradually more and more clear, at least to Syrians, throughout the early and mid-2000s, as his central role in mobilizing not just Syrians, but also foreigners who were flying into Damascus, flying into Aleppo, and then essentially being bussed for free into areas like Deir ez-Zor and also northeast Hasaka, which are exactly the same areas that ISIL has used in recent months and years to infiltrate its own fighters and transfer equipment and other supplies between Iraq and Syria. So people like Abu al-Qaqa are particularly important, or at least interesting to highlight. But throughout the US occupation of Iraq, Syria played an absolutely central role in terms of al-Qaeda in Iraq and then the Islamic State in Iraq's ability to continue to bring in flows of foreign fighters into Iraq to fight against the US-led occupation. I think at one point, I think it was in late 2007, US intelligence estimates suggested that at least 85 to 90% of all foreign fighters in Iraq had come from Syrian territory. And although it was only minimally made public at the time, many European states and the US were utterly convinced that at least Syrian military intelligence were playing a fairly prominent role in facilitating those foreign fighter networks traveling into Iraq. So the relationship between, at least in that respect, that was, of course, Bashar al-Assad's time as president. The relationship between the Assad family and jihadist militants has been, as I say, somewhat a complicated one. But certainly during Bashar al-Assad's time in power, he has quite explicitly sought to manipulate Sunni jihadist militants for Syrian foreign policy agendas. And the Iraq occupation was perhaps the most obvious one, but there were periods of time during the war in Iraq where some of these foreign fighter flows actually began to flow back into Syria. That was, of course, most notably probably in late 2006 and early 2007, when the surge had begun to show early results in places like Anbar province. And many of those fighters ended up suddenly back in Syrian territory, having been quite clearly sent into Iraq only months or years earlier. And what was interesting was, estimates vary according to people I've spoken to, but perhaps roughly 30% of those foreign fighters who flowed back into Syria were arrested by Syrian military intelligence and sent to prisons like Saidnaya outside Damascus. But a large majority of the rest of them were basically instructed to go to Lebanon. And it was there that they ended up teaming up with existing militant organizations like Fatah al-Islam in various Palestinian refugee camps, and most notably in Nahr al-Barad, where the so-called war of the camps took place in late 2007, I think, if I remember correctly. And it was exactly those kind of networks after their defeat in Nahr al-Barad. You know, I think at least 400 people were killed in almost 3 months of battles there. Many of those fighters were again then sent back into Iraq with Syrian military intelligence facilitation. And there were various claims being made at the time from inside Lebanon that Syria and the Assad regime had been directly implicated in essentially helping spark the conflict in Nahr al-Barad and elsewhere. And that kind of trend, continued throughout the late 2000s as the US was preparing to withdraw. And I guess if I was to name one, mention one other example of that kind of complicity, there's another famous case in early 2009, I think, when Syrian military intelligence was thought to have facilitated two meetings in the town of Zabadani near the Lebanese border between Iraqi Ba'ath Party, sort of militant oppositionists, and commanders or representatives of the Islamic State in Iraq. And those meetings have only become public because the Iraqi intelligence actually had a mole in the meeting who was wearing a wire. And I think this was documented first in a Guardian report when they interviewed a former member of Iraqi intelligence about those two meetings. But basically what was discussed in the meetings was that with the US withdrawal approaching, the idea was to allow or to help encourage the Islamic State in Iraq to carry out some spectacular attacks in Baghdad to sort of cripple the government in the capital as the US was withdrawing. Because one of the members of the meeting was wearing a wire and feeding back intelligence into Iraq, security was bolstered in Baghdad and in the Green Zone specifically for several months. But nonetheless, some of the biggest attacks ever to take place in the capital then did, I think, midway through that year in a pretty spectacular fashion. I think well over 100 people were killed. And it did have a fairly significant impact in terms of how Nouri al-Maliki perceived his future and Iraq's future with US military forces withdrawing from the country at the time. So as I say, to sum up a rather long answer, the Syrian regime, Assad perhaps himself, and certainly military intelligence specifically, have played a fairly significant role, both in the 1980s, through the late 1990s, and during the Iraq occupation. And they have continued to, during the revolution, in facilitating, manipulating, and exploiting Sunni jihadist militants for their own, both domestic and foreign policy agendas. And I think it's incredibly important to highlight that, especially at a time now when we're watching meetings taking place in Vienna, particularly in terms of discussing the shape of a potential transitional governing body in Syria and whether or not Assad himself plays a role in that. And as far as most opposition supporting Syrians are concerned, Assad's role and previous role in facilitating jihadists in Syria, both prior and during the revolution, means that he absolutely should not take part. And I think at points The sort of short-termism of current political discussions about Syria mean that much of that history is often ignored or forgotten.
Yeah, definitely. I agree on that for sure. Turning to the actual Syrian uprising that's turned into a civil war and proxy war and a whole bunch of other ways of describing it at this point, unfortunately. Can you talk about when, how, and why did jihadi elements begin to enter the Syrian uprising? And what were the different rationales between sort of the spectrum of groups such as Jabhat al-Nusra or Ahrar al-Sham and even Jaish al-Islam?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think another sort of overlooked reality was that jihadists and certainly Salafist Syrians were beginning to establish a role in revolutionary dynamics much earlier than is normally accepted. Of course, months of June and July 2011, so only several months into the revolution itself, and when protests were still taking place in many areas of the country, that kind of time period is well known to have been when the Free Syrian Army started to form in northern Syria. But what is perhaps less appreciated is that jihadists had also begun to come together at exactly that same time. Much of that was a consequence of the fact that, again, the Assad regime in at least two big swathes in March and in June 2011 released hundreds of Islamist prisoners from jail. And it was many of these Islamists who then went on to form groups like Ahrar al-Sham, Jaish al-Islam, Sukkur al-Sham, as well as Jabhat al-Nusra. And it was in June, mostly July, that these Islamists began to come together and essentially sort of reinitiate the same kind of sort of opposition, quote unquote, opposition networks that had existed within the Islamist community for many years in Syria. The more extremist end of that spectrum began also to come together in places like Homs and Aleppo and also outside Damascus. For initial kind of discussions about how they were going to establish some kind of armed organization or armed organizations to take advantage of the emerging chaos in the country. It was actually in about mid-August when a guy called Abu Muhammad al-Julani arrived in Hasaka in northeastern Syria from Nineveh province in northwestern Iraq. He had been sent in as a senior Islamic State in Iraq commander explicitly by Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the then leader of the Islamic State in Iraq. And he was sent in with six other individuals who were a variety of Syrians, Jordanians, and Saudis. And they were sent in with the explicit intention of establishing a Syrian wing of the Islamic State in Iraq in Syria, covertly at least at first. So from August, Jolani quickly made his way from Hasaka down to Homs and began to hold a series of secret meetings largely with Syrians who had been released, as I say, in June and in March from prison across the country, but primarily out of Damascus. And it was in these meetings that the first discussions took place about forming an organization called Jabhat al-Nusra. It took, I think from my sources at least, it took about 4 to 6 weeks for the organization to actually be established. So we were looking at least in terms of early October when the organization was formally created as an organization and not just as an idea. There are reports of Nusra being a sort of tacitly existing organization as early as July, but the formal establishment of the group took place in early October, perhaps in the middle of the month. So it was really at that point that an organized jihadist resistance began to emerge in the country. And a number of unclaimed attacks took place in rural Homs, again outside Damascus, also in parts of Aleppo, small sort of hit-and-run attacks against regime forces in Aleppo began to take place. And most of those were essentially informally linked to cells that came to form Jabhat al-Nusra. So it was actually really early on, because in fact it wasn't until December 2011 that Jabhat al-Nusra carried out its first attack. And then it wasn't until January 2012 that Jabhat al-Nusra actually publicly announced its emergence and claimed responsibility for that attack in December. So I guess one point to note was that the jihadists that came to form what was then basically a Syrian wing of the ISI, had taken several months to kind of covertly establish quite an effective organization by much of the same way, by exploiting pre-existing logistical jihadist networks that had existed during the Iraq occupation. And it was at that point, perhaps by January and February 2012, that the very first foreigners, or quote-unquote foreign fighters, began to arrive in Syria. Some of them came from Iraq, but many actually began to come in via the Turkish border. And those coming from Turkey were primarily members of the Chechen diaspora, already living in places like Turkey. And there were a few Libyans as well who started to come in early 2012. So the kind of foreign fighter networks that we have come to sort of acknowledge during the revolutionary years since 2011 began to establish themselves very early on, perhaps much earlier on than we might otherwise have accepted or recognized. In the first months of Jabhat al-Nusra's operations, it was actually a deeply unpopular group. Within opposition circles. I mean, quite quickly, the kinds of attacks the group were carrying out in Damascus and in Aleppo in particular, big spectacular suicide bombings in urban areas causing civilian casualties, reminded Syrians of what had been taking place in Iraq for many years. So the immediate reception of this new organization, Jabhat al-Nusra, was deeply negative. But what was fascinating was that really by August 2012, by the time conflict was really breaking out in Aleppo city itself, groups like Jabhat al-Nusra and several other smaller foreign fighter organizations had begun to quite consciously integrate themselves into the new emerging sort of popular revolutionary dynamics in Aleppo itself. And Aleppo was really critical for an organization like Jabhat al-Nusra to begin to be perceived by opposition supporting Syrians as not just a jihadist organization, but an organization that could perhaps be allied with within the broader dynamics of the revolution itself and within the dynamics of fighting the regime. And at that point, it wasn't actually, you know, the conventional wisdom, at least since 2013, 14, and 15, is that organizations like Ahrar al-Sham and to some extent Jaish al-Islam have been essentially effective incubators or guarantors for the prominent role of groups like Jabhat al-Nusra. And that has certainly definitely been the case throughout 2013, 14, and 15. But back then in 2012, their role in accepting an organization like Nusra within broader revolutionary dynamics was actually quite minimal. And much of the sort of quote-unquote hard work in terms of that integration was done by the jihadists themselves. And then the main advantage in that respect was that the conflict dynamics themselves were only still developing. And in the case of Aleppo, they were brand new. So the kind of the fight for Aleppo provided a group like Nusra sort of a perfect opportunity to introduce itself as a valuable player in the battles. So that sort of brings us to August, September 2012. In the months that followed, as the winter of 2012 started, Nusra began to present itself not just as a fighting organization, but also as a sort of social movement. So it was that first winter, 2012-13, that Nusra began to take control in Aleppo again of the bread production facilities in some opposition supporting areas in an attempt to try and present itself as an uncorrupted organization in comparison to several Free Syrian Army factions in the area, which had developed by that time a reputation for corruption and for selling bread at too high prices, for stealing water from civilians, from taxing people for crossing between different districts, etc., etc. So it was kind of from very early on at least after the first 4 months or so of Nusra's public operations, that the organization was making quite overt attempts to establish itself socially within the revolution itself, and not just presenting itself, at least in terms of how the ISI had done previously in Iraq, as a sort of explicitly jihadist movement that had immediate objectives to establish an Islamic state. You know, that kind of self-presentation just didn't happen in Syria. And I think that's why we've seen such a difference take place, comparing Jabhat al-Nusra and the way that the ISI fared in Iraq during the early 2000s, or the, you know, the from 2003 to 2010. If we're going to talk about groups like Ahrar al-Sham and Jaish al-Islam, you know, there are very significant qualitative differences in terms of their ideological outlook compared to Jabhat al-Nusra. But certainly with regards to Ahrar al-Sham, there are also some fairly significant likenesses between the two organizations. It's been, you know, very well documented that a number of individuals within Ahrar al-Sham senior leadership have had histories either within al-Qaeda or within al-Qaeda-linked circles. Abu Khalid al-Suri is probably the most famous example in that respect. Although he never actually joined al-Qaeda as an organization, he was certainly very well connected within al-Qaeda circles for many, many years before the Syrian revolution. And in fact, he was almost certainly rendered to Syria alongside Abu Musab al-Suri, one of al-Qaeda's most famous strategic ideologues, by the Americans. In the early 2000s, in the mid 2000s, I think it was. So Ahrar al-Sham has been a fascinating organization to watch, mostly because it the extent of its kind of jihadist foundation have sort of wavered over time. Very early on, I think it was an extremely conservative organization in its very early days, and certainly there were questions as to regards how it first began to acquire financial donations from abroad. There are certainly quite widespread allegations in Syria that Ahrar al-Sham's first sort of received financial donations from the Gulf were from explicitly al-Qaeda-linked financiers. But I think then quite quickly over time, countries like Qatar, to some extent Turkey early on, but mostly Qatar, and also people in Kuwait, began to establish more solid links with Ahrar al-Sham. And at that point, it started to sway a little bit further away from al-Qaeda and more as a sort of explicitly Syrian Salafi movement. I won't tell the entire story of how that group's evolved, but suffice to say that, as I say, that the extent of its sort of jihadist foundations has definitely gone up and down over time because of both internal and external considerations.
Yeah, definitely. In terms of going forward, since you already sort of gave a little bit of the history and evolution, as well as mentioning some of the foreign fighter aspects, can you talk a little bit more about how the foreign fighter motivations have changed over time, since the ones going in early 2012 definitely were going for different reasons than, say, somebody who's going now in November 2015?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first foreign fighters who began to arrive in Syria much more quietly in 2012 were going quite explicitly at the time to just simply fight Assad, to protect Sunni civilians, and potentially to help establish some kind of Islamically legitimate rule in their eyes. But the primary motivation was protection of civilians and to fight what was seen as a repressive, dictatorial regime who was killing or was responsible for killing civilians in very large numbers. And it did take quite some time for those kind of motivations to change, and you could probably signal that most to the emergence of ISIS or ISIL in Syria in April and May 2013. ISIL, as soon as it emerged in Syria, was quite qualitatively and ideologically different to Jabhat al-Nusra. Without going into detail about why those two organizations ended up in the same country together, the ideological difference had a fairly significant impact in terms of how foreign fighters began to see the conflict in Syria. One particular reason for that, of course, was the fact that Nusra and ISIL were essentially began to see each other as competitors for influence, competitors for jihadist influence. Nusra's role in Syria for a long time, as I said earlier, had maintained this kind of focus on having some extent of pragmatism with, in terms of interaction with civilians, in terms of interaction with other opposition groups, with the long-term intention of establishing genuinely durable roots into society and into the revolution, which then by extension would afford that organization with a better opportunity to establish Islamic Emirates in Syria in the long-term future. In some respects, that the success of that model by Nusra and by its leader, Abu Muhammad al-Jolani, that actually influenced ISIL to actually enter Syria in early 2013. And I've got a whole section in my book about the kind of backstory that preceded Baghdadi's announcement in April 2013 that ISIL was essentially going to try and subsume Jabhat al-Nusra under its command, which, as is well known, again, was rejected by Nusra itself. But because it was rejected, and because Syria suddenly found itself with two major jihadist organizations from really May 2013 onwards, the kind of competitive dynamic that then emerged between Nusra and ISIL meant that two kind of jihadist models slowly began to emerge in that country. And the ISIL model began to be qualitatively different from at least mid-2013 onwards. And it was reflected much more by, a far more explicit level of brutality, quite almost immediate imposition of Sharia or their interpretation of Sharia law. Executions by ISIL became an awful lot more common an event than had ever been the case under Jabhat al-Nusra anywhere else in the country. It was that kind of idea that ISIL was there to establish Islamic law one day, an Islamic State. Of course, they called themselves an Islamic State, so just in terms of their name, they had made their objectives that much more clear. Whereas Jabhat al-Nusra's name essentially means like a front for providing support to what was then a revolution and a popular movement to protect the Sunni people from oppression. So just in terms of their names, that difference had an impact in terms of how foreign fighters, now to these two organizations rather than just necessarily mostly to one, began to see the conflict in Syria. And of course, as the revolution developed and as the relationship between the opposition, including to some extent Nusra and ISIL, began to evolve and to deteriorate, that ideological distinction became ever more clear. And of course, as is well known, by the time ISIL established a caliphate crossing over Iraq and Syria, that was then blatantly clear. And in the months before ISIL's declaration of a caliphate in July 2014, ISIL's kind of public propaganda had already begun to shift into the form of presenting itself explicitly as a building, as an expanding Islamic State, in which sort of an idealized Islamic community was being built, in which the Sharia was being correctly enforced to its full authority and not to a limited extent, which it accused its competitors like Al-Qaeda of doing. So they were explicitly calling as an organization for foreign fighters not just to join a conflict, not just to join a revolution, but to actually establish or to help establish an Islamic State and one day a caliphate. Nusra's never really bought into that kind of recruitment strategy. They continue to present themselves as a movement fighting to protect Sunni civilians, fighting to destroy the repressive Shia and Alawite parties who are perceived to be fighting against the Sunni, the Sunnah. And I think that qualitative difference has had a very significant impact in terms of the type of foreign fighters who have joined both organizations. And I think what's been quite fascinating in terms of my engagement with both organizations over the last, or members of both organizations over the last few years, has been the fact that, and this is a generalization, but that some of the Western foreign fighters in particular who go on to join an organization like Jabhat al-Nusra appear to be much more kind of almost serious about their sort of duty to protect. Whereas the people going on to join organizations like ISIL, and again, I say this is a somewhat of a generalization, but are themselves much more focused on sort of apocalyptic objectives of dying for the cause of Allah in establishing a caliphate, in establishing an Islamic state, and imposing Sharia. And I think that kind of qualitative difference and that ideological difference has, as I say, had quite a significant impact. And it just so happens, I think, at least until recent history, that the recruitment strategy espoused by ISIL in using, you know, particularly extreme brutality and violence, and in very quickly establishing Islamic rule and a caliphate, has actually achieved a much greater scale of recruitment than perhaps Al-Qaeda's has. But then, of course, you can equally argue, as I do in my book, that perhaps Al-Qaeda's more long-term focused strategy might actually see it survive an awful lot longer in a place like Syria than ISIL's might.
Yeah. That still is yet to play out. So something to look forward to, I guess. To circle back a little bit, what you're just talking about is, can you get more into sort of what was the rationale for the Islamic State coming into Syria in April 2013?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there are thought to have been a variety of primary motivations. I mean, one very significant one was the fact that Abu Muhammad al-Jolani's model, as I described it earlier, had proven to be quite successful in terms of embedding Nusra within an ever more chaotic conflict in Syria. And for jihadist organizations, complexity is sort of a great thing to take advantage of. And certainly the success of Jolani had aroused a great deal of attention within the ISI senior circles in Iraq, not least just because of the success, but mostly also because Jolani and his senior Shura Council had begun to refuse to carry out specific orders being sent from Iraq. And some of those related to explicit orders to carry out attacks against the Syrian opposition coalition, the political opposition in southern Turkey. There were also several orders sent in to carry out assassinations of different, both Syrian and, in fact, former Iraqi rebel commanders in different areas of Syria. And there was a feeling developing in Iraq that within ISI circles that Jolani had begun to become his own sort of power in and of himself. And he was no longer altogether recognizing himself or acknowledging the fact that he was still essentially a junior partner of Baghdadi, who had, of course, sent him into Syria to establish the ISI's wing in Syria itself. So to some extent, there was some kind of jealousy is probably too strong a word, but the particular success being developed in Syria was not necessarily being translated in Iraq at that time in mid to late 2012. But also the model being carried out in Syria was quite qualitatively different to the model that had long been developed in Iraq by Zarqawi and his various successors, including Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. So the refusal to carry out some specific orders from Iraq inside Syria sort of kind of was like a nail in the coffin for a relationship of trust that had previously existed between Baghdadi, his deputy Haji Bakr, and Jabhat al-Nusra's leader, Abu Muhammad al-Jolani. So really, it was actually in late 2012 that a final order was sent in secret from Baghdadi to Jabhat al-Nusra's Shura Council to release a public statement for the first time acknowledging that Nusra was a sort of subsidiary organization of the Islamic State in Iraq. And this was kind of the final big order from Iraq that was again refused by Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria. And so it was at that point very quickly that Haji Bakr, and almost certainly for a period of time, the ISI's chief spokesman, Syrian Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, were both sent into northern Syria in December 2012 to essentially give a final ultimatum to Jabhat al-Nusra that unless it finally came out again, you know, they basically repeated the order, unless you issue a public statement announcing or admitting your links to us, essentially we'll take matters into our own hands. And I've got a whole section in the book about this based on interviews with very, very well-connected Islamists and jihadists within those circles who were aware of these, or who were kind of quietly aware of these discussions going on in December 2012 and January 2013. Again, the order was, at this time, because it was in person, was kind of quietly refused or quietly denied. But it was at that point that the ISI's several commanders, including Haji Bakr, began to establish relationships with foreign fighter cells within Nusra, and also within several sort of Nusra front groups that had been established in places like Latakia and Aleppo and also in northern Homs. And these kind of covert contacts that began to take place in early 2013 were with the intention of the ISI essentially securing unofficial pledges of allegiance, primarily, as I say, from foreign fighters within Jabhat al-Nusra's broader command. There are some claims that in early 2013, Baghdadi himself actually made it into northern Syria himself to sort of further add to the sort of seniority of those requests for pledges of allegiance from foreigners, particularly from Saudis at the time within Nusra. And of course, it was only a couple months later in April 2013. By that time, Nusra had continued to refuse to issue its own statement. And it was in April 2013 that Baghdadi, he essentially carried out a hostile takeover of Nusra. As you know, and as is well documented, his statement essentially ordered Nusra to subsume itself within the ISI's command. He acknowledged publicly for the first time that Nusra had been established as a wing of the ISI, that it had received 50% of the ISI's funding since its public establishment in Syria, and that from here on out, Jabhat al-Nusra didn't exist anymore, and it would in the future, be called the Islamic State in Iraq and al-Sham, or ISIS. And of course, as is very well known, Jolani himself came out and refused to accept that order, refused to accept that new status. And from that point on, both Nusra and ISIS existed as two separate organizations. Again, the kind of conventional history of this being a statement, you know, in Jolani's reply to Baghdadi's statement in April 2013, he said, "We have never been aware that you plan to issue this statement, and we deny that we will ever be subsumed under your authority." But he had been very, very well aware, and in fact, much of the broader Salafist and jihadist community, particularly in northern Syria, had been very well aware of various machinations and debates and struggles that had been going on between these two organizations for several months before, dating back at least to late 2012. So Jilani had been well aware that Baghdadi was trying to pull him back under his command. But his consistent refusal to do so meant that essentially this kind of hostile takeover took place in April 2013. And the consequences of that, of course, are very well known.
So what has the growth of IS meant for the Syrian uprising then, as well as the three other factions we've talked about previously, Nusra, Ahrar, and Jaish al-Islam?
Well, I mean, the growth of an organization like IS has had a profound impact on the trajectory of the revolution. Of course, you know, from the moment at which it established a caliphate crossing both Iraq and Syria, it fundamentally transformed the dynamics of the entire conflict in Syria. I mean, no longer was ISIS seen as an organization that in any means might be fighting the Syrian regime for whether it be to protect Sunni civilians or whether it be to sort of, you know, benefit the revolution. I mean, that the belief in that respect had largely disappeared by that point, but there were Islamists who still believed that ISIL may have been rescuable, and that it may still come back into the sort of revolutionary umbrella. But certainly in the months since then, the fact that ISIL has controlled, you know, a good third of the country, albeit much of that being desert, has meant that a good portion of the country kind of ceased to be part of the revolution, and that many, many Syrians now see fighting ISIL as kind of a long-term objective. It's something that they don't necessarily see that they have the resources for at the moment, unless we're looking at specific front lines like north of Aleppo. Nusra is seen as like a real major headache that will have to be dealt with if and whenever the Assad regime is pushed aside or defeated, at least in terms of that's how they see it. But it's also damaged the revolution in many Syrians' eyes because the kind of sheer shock value of an organization like ISIL and its capability to take advantage of international news headlines by whether it be by executing Western hostages or by carrying out attacks abroad, by expanding as a major international jihadist organization across the world. The fact that it has such a high profile has meant that the international community has begun to look at Syria in a much more different light. Syria is no longer a country in which there is a popular revolution fighting against the Assad regime, but now there is this added element of this major jihadist organization who, are potentially transforming international borders, who now may be carrying out quite significant attacks in Europe, such as the claim we've seen from Paris. So it's had a fairly significant implication in terms of how the Western world has approached the Syrian opposition and has begun to approach certainly in the last few weeks in terms of the Vienna process that we're watching at the moment, in terms of how they see a potential transition taking place in Syria. You know, that the idea that Assad could play any role in a political transition was almost non-existent in Europe and the US, even perhaps 6 months ago. But the fact that ISIL has continued to exist in such a strong fashion in Syria means that now Assad is, in some people's eyes, seen as a potentially better alternative to ISIL. Of course, there are many other alternatives than just those two, but it's not always seen in that light in political circles in the West today. How has Jabhat al-Nusra's growth and development in Syria impacted the revolution? Its model, as I described earlier, has been quite profoundly successful in terms of embedding the organization within revolutionary dynamics. And it has ensured the fact that a vast swathe of Islamist opposition circles, including genuinely sort of moderate/mainstream Islamists, continue to refuse to condemn in any way the role that Jabhat al-Nusra has played within the revolution and within the conflict in Syria, which essentially gives al-Qaeda a major sort of insurance policy. It knows that it has managed to embed itself so durably within the revolution that even moderate Syrians refuse to kind of, you know, explicitly or at least publicly renounce Al-Qaeda's role in the conflict. And even vetted, you know, even vetted and other moderate Free Syrian Army factions find it extremely difficult to come out even in private and say anything bad about Nusra. Although they distrust their long-term objectives, most of the positions of many of these groups is still, we still haven't seen anything bad from Jabhat al-Nusra, so why should we come out and condemn them, let alone fight against them on the ground? So that in and of itself has also transformed both dynamics inside Syria, but also, again, in terms of how the Western world sees the revolution, how the Western world sees the opposition in general, which, of course, has significant implications for how things might turn out in the future. I guess one could say, one could tell a similar story for an organization like Ahrar al-Sham, which, as I say, that there are quite significant ideological differences between how the leadership of Ahrar al-Sham sees Syria's future and how the leadership of Jabhat al-Nusra sees Syria. There are quite significant differences there. And certainly on a sort of popular level within opposition circles in Syria, Ahrar al-Sham is far more broadly accepted as a kind of representative of the Syrian revolution than Jabhat al-Nusra is. So definitely an organization like Ahrar al-Sham, I would say, you know, whether we and the West like it or not, is probably going to play a fairly significant role in Syria's future in some form, politically or militarily. I think that's almost unavoidable at this point. It's managed to become arguably the biggest militant organization in Syria, but it's also got a particularly powerful and influential sort of civil wing, a humanitarian assistance wing, and also now increasingly a policing capability, which they are presenting through their various regional backers as a potential model for a post-Assad, a kind of, you know, transitional period in terms of policing quote-unquote liberated areas. Jaish al-Islam is a much more complicated picture. I would say that Jaish al-Islam is actually, on a fighter-by-fighter level, a much more moderate Islamist organization. I think on a leadership level, individuals like Zahran al-Ulusha are extraordinarily unpredictable. And the kind of rhetoric he has particularly used himself to describe Jaish al-Islam's role in the revolution has often appeared extraordinarily sectarian and extreme in terms in many people's eyes, but the organization isn't nearly as conservative as someone like as an organization like Ahrar al-Sham. And in fact, one way in which that's now being translated is the fact that with Syria becoming even more complex, including after the Russian military intervention, several European states are actually now quietly exploring the idea that very, very solid relationships ought to be established with Jaish al-Islam, particularly because of its influence in Damascus, but with eyes looking towards a sort of post-solution era, or at least during a transition. There seems to be an acceptance that Jaish al-Islam should, not just could, play some kind of prominent role. So there's quite a significant difference, as I say, between those organizations, despite the kind of rhetoric that we might have seen in public. Certainly in private and in official meetings, Jaish al-Islam comes across as a much more sort of serious and mainstream actor than we might otherwise have thought.
So going forward then, first, what's the current status of all these key actors, IS, JAN, Ahrar, and Jaish al-Islam? And where do you see things heading in the near term? Since obviously anything longer than the near term is pretty unpredictable, as I think you and I have come to realize looking at what's been going on in Syria over the last 5 years.
Exactly, the danger of making predictions on Syria. What is the status? I mean, I actually think that ISIL actually probably faces the most potential challenges in the near-term future of any sort of major opposition or jihadist organization in Syria. I think the recent regime gains around Quirra's airport and in southern Aleppo are actually really quite potentially very significant, especially in terms of the message that that has sent to the West, in terms of the fact that ISIS isn't infallible, and that the Syrian army and allied militia forces with Russian air support is capable of potentially bearing down on a major ISIL front line. And I think that it's not altogether impossible that the West may actually buy into that idea, that if Russia focuses its resources on areas like that, on the sort of southeastern Aleppo front, towards some of ISIS's most important Aleppo towns, heading towards Raqqa, that could have a quite significant impact in terms of how the West starts to see Russia's actions in Syria. Of course, that would depend on Russia also abiding by those expectations. But I think that that's one potential direction that things might be going in at the moment. Another potential threat to ISIS, of course, comes from north of Raqqa, where the Kurdish YPG and its various allied forces, including the Syrian Arab Coalition, within this new umbrella organization, the Syrian Democratic Forces. I think it appears that major preparations are underway now for at least several offenses, actually, in northeastern Syria against major ISIL targets. And again, I don't think ISIL is necessarily infallible in this respect. And I think that it is quite possible in that area, with US close air support, that ISIL may again be forced to incur some fairly significant losses. And once ISIL incurs, you know, a loss after a loss after a loss, then its self-presented image of an organization that is continually demonstrating momentum on the battlefield will seriously be brought into the question. And there are already rumors within places like Raqqa City of quite debilitating amounts of paranoia and security crackdowns within ISIL as an organization, not just within civilian populations in its midst, resulting from the fact that there are serious suspicions of informers within their ranks, that targeted killings, including the one that apparently recently killed Jihadi John, resulted from human intelligence on the ground within ISIL itself. All of that, I think, can have quite a significant impact in terms of how a jihadist organization manages to continue to control territory. The outlook for Nusra, on the other hand, I would say is bright. I think they have, as I earlier said, established themselves quite so durably within revolutionary dynamics, particularly in the northwest of the country, which is where I think it's definitely investing the most right now, that I think it will be extraordinarily difficult within current conditions, if not impossible, to root them out from those kind of areas. And there I'm talking about, you know, the very northern tips of Latakia, throughout much of Idlib, throughout a little bit of northern Homs, and some of Hama. Through their military strategy, as well as their social strategy, and also their use of a variety of small front groups, and their establishment of close relationships with other Islamist organizations in the area, has ensured that, that it is definitely a very durable, has a very durable presence in the north of the country, at the very least. In terms of Ahrar al-Sham, I would say much the same. I think in many respects, Ahrar al-Sham is now emerging as more of a political actor. I think this first sign of that came in terms of the organization's role in negotiations with Iran over Zabadani and several small villages in the north of Syria. Those negotiations were essentially conducted directly between Ahrar al-Sham, representing the entire opposition, and Iran, representing Iran and the Assad regime somewhat. And that's an extraordinarily significant message that was sent. By then, you know, Turkey was kind of facilitating those negotiations. So Turkey had essentially propped up Ahrar al-Sham as its representative. But Qatar also played a role, and there was an awful lot of back briefing going on between Ahrar al-Sham and Doha during those negotiations. People flying between Doha and Istanbul, certainly on a number of occasions, ensuring that Qatar was playing some kind of indirect role, at least in those negotiations. So I think, but a combination of Qatar and Turkey has ensured that a group like Ahrar al-Sham has, again, as I earlier said, probably ensured that it will be playing a very significant political role, as well as a military one, throughout much of the coming months and potentially years, whether or not there's a transition in Syria. There are even rumors going on now within opposition circles that Ahrar al-Sham may have some kind of sort of indirect role in trying to have some kind of statement presented in Vienna in quiet, or at least in terms of other meetings with, bilateral meetings in Vienna during these multinational negotiations. So I think that's, that sends a very significant message if that's true. So with Turkey's support, Ahrar has acquired a very significant role in the conflict. Jaish al-Islam will continue to exploit the fact that it is by far the most powerful armed group in Damascus. And I think it is certainly presenting itself as such in the hope that the Western world will begin to see it as a much more acceptable partner within opposition circles. And as I said, there do appear to be several European states who are now considering that possibility, that with some coaching and with some kind of guarantees, Jaish al-Islam may very well be an organization that the West needs to have much closer contact with than in the past, mostly to sort of afford against any kind of potential fall of Damascus scenario in which the city falls under jihadist control. That's, the biggest fear in European and American capitals. Much as it is, at least in my eyes, impossible that ISIL would, in that scenario, take over Damascus. There is that belief within Western political capitals. So I think probably Jaish al-Islam doesn't have quite as bright a future necessarily as Ahrar might, with Turkish and Qatari backing, but it is definitely getting there. So the kind of overall scenario for Islamists in general in Syria is far more positive than perhaps for the more moderate end of the spectrum.
Yeah. Well, sadly, this conflict does not appear like it's going to end anytime soon. But thanks for coming onto the show today, Charles, and at least walking us through many of the key dynamics within the jihadi spectrum of this war.
Yeah, no problem at all, Aaron. It was great to be on the show. There's certainly an awful lot to talk about, but I'm sure there'll be many more discussions.
Indeed, and good luck with the book sales.
Thank you.
This episode's hashtag social media segment will cover postings from November 11th through the 20th.
During that time span, 5 foreign fighters were announced killed by the Islamic State inside of Iraq, while during that same time, 2 foreign fighters were announced killed in Syria by a variety of groups.
On November 11th, Ansar al-Sharia in Libya's Dawa office restores roads in Darna.
On the same day, wilayat Nineveh of the Islamic State builds a street that connects 2 ends of the city.
On November 12th, wilayat Raqqa of the Islamic State does a tour of the new school year at various schools in the province.
Also on the 12th, Wilayat Kirkuk of the Islamic State builds townhouses.
On November 13th, the Islamic State releases its official calendar for the Islamic month of Safar.
On November 15th, Wilayat Tarablus of the Islamic State passes out candy to celebrate the Paris attacks to local residents in Sirte, Libya.
On November 16th, Wilayat Halab of the Islamic State shows off its internal bus service from the city of Minbij, Syria.
On November 17th, Wilayat al-Raqqa of the Islamic State builds a new bridge in the city of Al-Tabqa.
On November 18th, Wilayat Khorasan of the Islamic State opens a new military training camp named after Sheikh Jalal al-Din in eastern Afghanistan.
On November 19th, Wilayat Halab of the Islamic State does embroidery work in the town of Baza'a, Syria.
Also on the 19th, Wilayat Halab of the Islamic State does aluminum smelting, making pots and plates.
On November 20th, Wilayat Khorasan of the Islamic State destroys graves in eastern Afghanistan.
And finally, on the 20th as well, Wilayat Dijla of the Islamic State breeds chickens. If you have any feedback, you can email us, podcast@jihadology.net, or find us on Twitter, where we are @jihadpod. If you're a fan of the show, please check out the Patreon link in the show notes, where you can make a small donation to help support the podcast and get some cool rewards like access to bonus content that Aaron and I have been putting out. As always, the show is available in iTunes and Stitcher. If you use one of those platforms, please rate and review the podcast, which will help more people discover the show.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Jihadology podcast. Thanks to Charles for coming onto the show and sharing his expertise with us. Also, thanks to the Podmaster Carl Moran for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly. Until next time, I'm out.